I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
It's just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hello and welcome to Books of the Year, your favourite podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, because we only do this one.
Yes, so we will be the favourite one, won't we?
Yeah. An email from Kenny Blythe, who is the actor who did the voiceover, who did the audiobook for The Killing Stones.
Oh, right. Okay.
Who's got in touch? Ah. Dear Bookworms, I just wanted to drop you a short message to say thank you for your very kind words on The Killing Stones episode with Anne Cleves.
Ah.
Anne has always been such a great supporter of my readings of her books, and it was so nice to hear that you enjoyed the audio version, because he does a fantastic, absolutely fantastic job. I'm very much enjoying listening now to previous episodes of the podcast, particularly enjoyed the Jonathan Friedland episode. I was lucky enough to work with him on The Long View on Radio 4 when I was on the Radio Drama Company, dashing across London, recording in the National Gallery and a wee East London print works, even the oldest surviving London jail. The Julian Assange episode, I think that was. Anyway, it's a fascinating programme. Wishing you a happy new year, and wishing you both and the show every continued success. Feel free to shout if you need any voices.
Oh, well.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's Kenny Blythe, whose work you can hear on the audiobook of Killing Stones. I meant many others as well, but Killing Stones. We spoke to Anne Cleves just before Christmas, because it's a great kind of Christmassy book, and Kenny is the voice that you'll hear on that.
Yeah, so an email from Emily in Norfolk. Simon and Matt, I saw Hamlet in the cinema the other day and it blew me away. The performances were stunning and the story, wow, not a dry eye in the house. I see that it's an adaptation from a book by Maggie O'Farrell. I haven't read any of her books before, but I really want to now. My question to you both, however, is how do you feel about going back to a book if you've watched a screen adaptation first? Does it matter? I tend to like to do it the other way around. Thanks for the great pod. So is this a question saying you've read the book before, you then go and see the movie, would you ever go back to the book again and read it again, given that you're sort of you now have those characters have been made flesh on the screen, haven't they?
That's interesting. I don't think I would. I'm not a great second read. I don't often go back to books. I honestly don't know what the answer to that is. I don't think I would. I would enjoy. I enjoyed reading Hamlet. Maggie O'Farrell is a fantastic writer. It's an extraordinary book. The play was apparently very good. I didn't see that. I agree about the movie. The movie is terrific, but they've done their own version. You know, it's not, it isn't the same. Would I go back and read the book? I don't think
so. I think I'm the same as you. I don't tend to read books twice, because I just feel that I'm therefore missing out on another book that I could be reading instead. So that would stop me there. Also, yeah, I agree with you. I think the whole thing about whether a book is better than the movie version of it, they're two completely different art forms. So it feels a little ridiculous to compare them. Even though it's the same story and the same characters, it always feels wrong to,
yes,
to sort of put one against the other, because it just doesn't make sense.
So in Hamlet, the film revolves far more around William Shakespeare than the novel does, but they are two completely different things. I mean, they're obviously linked, but I think they should be treated separately. But the answer to your question, Emily in Norfolk, is
no.
No, I don't think I would go back, unless I think the only circumstances under which that might happen is if I was appalled by what they'd done to a favourite book.
Oh, yeah.
I might go back and just go, no, I just want to remember exactly how it was.
Yeah.
Under those circumstances. Anyway, you can email us at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky. Pick any page. Let's speak to our best-selling author who joins us down the line from the United States of America. All right, let's welcome Kathy Reichs to the show. Hello, Kathy. You're very welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Where do we find you? In the Carolinas somewhere, I imagine.
Yes, I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay, and how is it today?
It's cold and rainy. It's maybe, I don't know how it converts to your system, but it's maybe, I don't know, 45 degrees here.
Okay.
That's cold for us, so.
All right. I mean, in Britain, we like to talk about the weather quite a lot, you know, so it's just nice to paint a picture.
I think it's very British weather. It's cold and rainy. So
okay.
You'd feel right at home.
I can see all your, well, some of your best-selling books just over your right shoulder. Is that what that
means,
right?
Yes, there they are. Some of them. And the new one on the bottom.
Okay. All right. And the new one is, of course, Evil Bones. Now, we have a slightly different cover to the one that's available in America. Matt, describe the cover that we have here.
Yeah, the one that we've got, dominant colours of blue and red. So it's blue and, well, very dark blue and even black at the top. And then we have a figure right at the bottom running away from us. And she's dressed in a red jacket. She's running away, clearly in terror, towards the, well, we're going to, let's say that's the sun rising or maybe the sun setting, which is providing the red. And then on the ground, we can see silhouettes of crosses that she's running through in these woods. The global bestseller, Kathy Reichs in red, a Temperance Brennan novel, Evil Bones in big, bold white letters. And then below that, one of my favourite writers, says Karen Slaughter.
That's what we're talking about. So it's Evil Bones, which is the new Kathy Reichs book. Is this the 24th, Kathy?
24, yes.
Okay. Who knew? And do you, just before we get into the meat and bones of this, of the story, does it still thrill you? Is it still exciting to have, you know, finished a manuscript, sign it off, and for publication day to come around?
It's very satisfying. It's probably not as exciting as the first book when it was, you know, wow, over the top exciting. But yeah, it's very satisfying to see it come to fruition and get the editing process finished and the artwork process and finally hold the thing in your hands.
Just in case there are people listening to us who haven't read a Temperance Brennan novel, introduce us to her and the kind of woman that she is.
Temperance Brennan does what I did for decades, actually. She's a forensic anthropologist, which means she's a specialist in the human skeleton. So she studies bones, name of the TV show that was the spinoff from the books, to determine, she works with law enforcement and with medical examiners and with coroners and sometimes with, I don't know, the military, sometimes with lawyers. Anyway, helping mainly with two questions. One would be identity. You know, who is this? We found a body in the woods or washed ashore from the river or wherever, a shallow grave. Who is it? And what happened? What was the manner or cause of death? What happened to that person?
Do people think they know and understand forensic anthropology now? And I just wonder if sometimes it helps to know what the barriers are, you know, what it is and also what it isn't.
Well, I think they know better now than they did when I wrote that first book, 30 years ago? I don't think back then anybody had any clue what a forensic anthropologist was. Given that Bones was on air for 12 seasons in something like 100 foreign territories, it was all over the world. We were everywhere. It was hard to avoid us. I think that really introduced people to what a forensic anthropologist is. So there's a much broader understanding of it now than there was, you know, back in the day.
And where does Evil Bones take us that we haven't been before? Just introduce us to where Temperance is for this.
It takes place in my hometown in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I think of it, I give each of my books kind of a nickname. And I think of this one as the animal book. And it focuses, the theme is, it starts with a rather gruesome scene of the discovery of a displayed animal carcass on a tree, I think it was. It's been, 2 years since I wrote this book?
Yes, okay.
3 years. So it's a year in the writing, a year in production, and then, you know, another year has gone by. So she begins investigating a series of animal killings. And, of course, the fear is this sicko, this perpetrator, going to escalate to humans? And then, of course, that happens.
So have you, if this is in your mind, the animal book, have you not gone to forensic veterinary medicine before?
I have not. I won't say that it might not have appeared as a peripheral, you know, consult situation in an earlier book, but it was not the central theme of any of the earlier books, which is why I chose it. I try to do a different one in each book, whether it's, you know, forensic, I don't know, mitochondrial DNA from cat hair, or it's fire and arson, or whatever the driving clues are that ultimately lead to this solving of the crime.
So, Kathy, anyone listening to this book who, or listening to this podcast who's perhaps not read your book before will already have in their heads what they can expect when they open it up, which obviously is going to involve, as you've said, these gruesome scenes of animals that have been nailed to trees. So there's going to be blood and gore and all of that kind of stuff. What I don't think they're going to be expecting is the level of humour within the book, and that runs right through it. So I just wanted to talk to you about that, because there's a sort of this sort of cliche that autopsy are riven with humour because of the dreadful nature of the business they're conducting. But it does run through your book, and it feels to me that must be deliberate. It's a deliberate choice to make this, to have Temperance being as funny as we possibly can without pushing that boundary too far.
Yeah, and that was true in the show as well. We tried in Bones, in the show with Emily Deschanel and David Boreanaz, we put humour. We were, I think they dubbed a term for us. They called us a crimity. We were the first crimity.
That's not a good word. Come on, Kathy, you're a writer. You must be going, excuse me? No.
Well, yeah, it kind of gets the idea across. But anyway, that is deliberate. I do put humor into the books, and that's a balancing act, because every book or every episode of the show dealt with violent death. So how do you put, you know, humor in there and not be offensive? You do have to be very delicate with it.
But is that a reflection of how it is in reality? You've obviously got experience in that field. So are the people in that field using comedy a lot? Are they trying to make each other laugh because of the gruesome nature of what they're doing?
Well, there is some black humor, you know, when you're in the autopsy room. There are, the one exception is if it's a child autopsy, and then it's just absolutely silent. There are no jokes at all. But otherwise, there is some dark humor that goes on in the autopsy room.
So it's gallows humor, really, yeah. Which the reader is probably very grateful for, Kathy, because you've explained where Temperance is and the work that she's doing. And if it just lightens the load, doesn't it? Because if all we had in this book were the details and the crime being solved, that'd be quite a tough read, wouldn't it?
Well, I think so. And when I'm reading a book of that nature, I appreciate some humor in there, as long as it's clever and it's witty and it's not, you know, hit you over the head with a dumbbell kind of humor. But no, I think it sets the tone for the story. It also allows you pacing. There are times when the humor is appropriate. There are scenes in which the humor is not appropriate. So you have to know where to put it and who to be using it, who to be saying what.
So the title is Evil Bones, and there is a discussion which Temperance has, quite a long conversation about the nature of evil and what is perceived as evil and who we perceive as evil. Explain how you decided to do that and tackle that. Obviously, it's a conversation which has been going on for thousands of years. I notice in the acknowledgements, there's a document that you credit called The Anatomy of Evil by Michael Stone. I just wondered what made you want to discuss this.
You know, I'm always on the lookout for new ideas for books, and I probably stumbled across someone using the word evil, or I can't remember the exact trigger or the exact clue, but I remember thinking, well, that would be a good topic to investigate. How do different, because not every society defines evil in the same way. So how do different cultures define evil, and then how do they deal with it? What's acceptable levels of evil and what is absolutely not? I guess there are some universals, you know, murdering children, although there have been cultures that sacrifice children to their gods, that sort of thing. But, you know, what is evil? How do we define evil? And then how do we deal with evil? That interested me, those questions.
I always have the reaction, I imagine the same will be true in America. When there is a particularly gruesome case happens, sometimes police chiefs or judges or people in the legal process will say this person was evil. And it always seems to me like an excuse for not examining why it happened. It's like we can park it over there. This is evil. It's beyond our comprehension. That's not what you're doing. It seems to me we are trying to understand where this came from.
And it was exactly what you describe. It was that which led to my interest in the question of what is evil? How do we define it? And how does it vary as to what the definitions of evil are? And how do we deal with it? What do we accept? What do we absolutely not accept?
Which takes me to a question about this, the escalation that we sense during your book. Because as you say, it starts with a sort of small animals being displayed, but then ramps up as the book progresses. And that, when Simon was asking you about the evil act, that was the point where I was like, okay, there is going to come a line in this book where this goes from being a little bit gruesome to, oh my goodness, I don't want to be reading this book in the dark, because there's going to be this feels like something evil is going on. So is it is that a deliberate act by you of, I want the reader to feel wary as they progress through this book?
I think my job as a thriller author, that's my job. Yes, it's going to make people fearful. It's going to, make them probably want to read it with the lights on at night, hopefully. I mean, that sounds like a cliche from a book cover, but
no.
Yeah, that's what a thriller, I think that's why people read a thriller. It's not just a mystery. It's not a cozy. It's a thriller, which means there is some threat either to the main character or to those close to the main character, which makes the reader think, well, this could be a threat to me or people that I love.
Yeah. Cozy, this is not.
No,
this
it's
is
not. No,
there's a lot of cozy on cozy crime on television at the moment, and what Kathy comes up with has never been cozy. I'm interested in this kind of thing. I was looking up evil as a word, and it's a very old English word. I think it comes from Kent originally, and it was used. I think it was just. It sort of escalated. It used to be used in terms of just bad. And in fact, in the 13th century, there are cases in the UK, Kathy, of evil child being a surname.
So, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Imagine that. Hello, I'm child. Brian Evil Child. But where is the area that everyone agrees is that sort of moral wickedness? Is that, do we all agree that that's the territory we're talking about?
Yeah. And is there anything, what interested me is there anything universally, that everybody agrees is whatever you just said, moral wickedness.
Moral wickedness. That's where I'm going.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need. I don't want to go into too much detail here. Okay.
Okay.
But there's your book touches on this area, Kathy. I don't know what you think, but I was in Paris recently, and by mistake ended up going. We couldn't go to all the museums that we wanted to because they were all sold out. We ended up going around a museum of taxidermy. And it was absolutely hated it. I mean, I'm sure there were very good examples of stuffed animals.
Yeah.
But for the life of me, I could not get my head around what would make someone be excited about taxidermy. Kathy, it comes up in your book. It's weird, isn't it? People who like that taxidermy are just weird.
Well, and there are actually, there's a scene in the book of a convention or a conference, gathering.
Yeah.
Taxidermists. And that actually was happening right here in North Carolina. There was a, United Society of North American Taxidermists or something was meeting here. I guess it's like any other profession, though. You get together and you view presentations and you talk to colleagues and you learn the latest techniques and products that are available for taxidermy, how to market your taxidermy, whatever taxidermists talk about. So, and Tempe and Slidell, I think, go to this conference. And of course, Slidell is just out of his element. So that is one of the things that I like, is to create scenes that are going to lend themselves to humor. And Skinny Slidell at a taxidermy conference. Just, I couldn't pass that up.
No, it struck me you must have been to one of these conferences, and I'd be intrigued to know what your sort of gut reaction was when you were walking around that room, because it certainly came across in, well, it felt to me came across in the book that I'd have been on the side of Slidell, of just being slightly unnerved, same as Simon, slightly unnerved by what I was seeing.
Less so for someone who works normally in autopsy rooms. You know, I've done that for longer than I'm going to admit to. So when you've been around cadavers and, you know, dissected corpses and autopsies, it's maybe not as disturbing as it might be for.
So the only way to not feel unnerved by going to one of these conferences is to have spent your career dissecting corpses. That would be the way that it would be okay.
Yeah, become a pathologist. Yes. You know? Or, I don't know, there must be other professions where taxidermy, for example. Yeah. What do you call the people who prepare funeral prepper?
There's a name for that.
Funeral directors, undertakers?
No, the guys that actually do the preparation of the...
Of the body, you know, to make it look...
Embalmers.
Embalmers, yeah.
But at least we still... At least I can understand why you would do that. Going around this taxidermy museum, is this still a thing in the 21st century? Do we still like to look at an otter that's been stuffed, or a badger that's been stuffed? What? I'm sorry, if that's your interest, then I mark you down as weird.
Okay.
Well, what's more perhaps unusual, peculiar, I don't know, bizarre, is people who have their beloved pets stuffed.
Yeah.
You know, and then they can have Fluffy or Fido with them forever.
Spare me. I mean,
not my thing, but
you mentioned Skinny Slidell. Just so we spend most of the time with Temperance and also with Erskine Slidell. Just tell us a bit more about him and where he fits in and how he helps you tell the story.
Yeah, Skinny. Temperance Brennan works in, as did I, for decades, works in two jurisdictions. One is in Charlotte, North Carolina, and one is in Montreal, in Quebec. And on each end of that geographically rather strange arrangement, she works closely with I don't know, we could call him a partner, I suppose. So it's Andrew Ryan up in Quebec, and it's Skinny Slidell, who's a detective in Charlotte, North Carolina. Skinny can be a bit rough around the edges. He's a bit, I don't know, what we might call a redneck. Do you know what a redneck is?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's a bit of a redneck. And he's got kind of a gruff sense of humor. But at the end of the day, Skinny's a good guy and he's a good detective. So while he can be very irritating and annoying to be with, Tempe works well with Skinny. And they always get their... I was going to say their man, but let's say they always get their villain.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that's, again, that is something you need to have, because my guess is that the person doing Temperance's job, in other words, the job that you used to do, would not normally be going out and doing the detective work, would not be doing that kind of legwork. They'd be leaving it to a detective, as you have in those situations. So was that a sort of device you're using? Because we as the reader, we want to be taken along with those sort of detective ride-alongs, for want of a better word.
And you're absolutely correct. I did go to scenes, to death scenes. I was going to say crime scenes, but it's not always a crime. But I did go to death scenes, but always with a police team or a team from the medical examiner or the coroner's office. So she does work with Slidell on a regular basis. They're not exactly partners, but they do a lot of casework together, much as she did with Celie Booth on the TV show. She worked a lot with an FBI agent, much more so than I ever worked with any particular detective or agent.
Would you have made a good detective, Kathy?
It's a good question. I think so. I have a good, my mind is, you are a bit of a detective when you're a forensic scientist. You know, you're presented with a problem. In my case, and I was always part of a team investigating, and I happened to be the part of the team along with the forensic pathologist or the forensic dentist working on the actual victim his or herself, you know, doing the autopsy, or the dentist would be analyzing the teeth, I would be analyzing the bones, the pathologist would be analyzing the soft tissue. So I think we did detective work in a sense, in that we would be presented with an unknown, a question, you know, who is it, for example, and then we would do what we could to try to contribute to an identification. Or the question, you know, what was the manner or cause of death? Was it a homicide, a suicide, an accidental, a natural, or unknown? I think those were the only five categories. And then as many details as we could give the investigating officers about the answers to those questions. So, you know, we were, am I wandering away from your question?
No, not at all, because obviously the Temperance and you have a degree of overlap, but I kind of think that Temperance would be a great cop. If she had no cop assistance, but she did have kind of legal powers, she'd be pretty cool, really.
She might be. She's not all that, socially sophisticated. She's not all that smooth. Her people skills could use some improvement. So in that sense, she might not have made the greatest cop in dealing with either suspects or victims, but she certainly would have had the instincts for solving the mystery, solving the crime.
If I were to go off at a bit of a tangent here, Kathy, you take us into an area that I had literally never heard of before, which is urban spelunking, which was a complete new thing for me. Explain to us all what urban spelunking involves, and also whether you've ever done it, Kathy. I'm sure you have.
Yeah, well, no, not really. spelunking is cave exploring. So urban spelunking is going into, as I understand it, I'll probably get lots of emails from urban spelunkers, going into abandoned structures, whether they're, you know, old bomb shelters or abandoned warehouses or underground, I don't know, tunnels or whatever, and exploring them as a spelunker might go into caves and explore the tunnels and passageways of caves.
I genuinely had never heard of it here, and I don't know whether, because obviously it requires there to be a lot of abandoned buildings. Is it peculiarly an American thing, or as far as you know, is this something that's worldwide?
I don't think it's just an American thing. And if you Google it, I mean, the knowledge of the world is at our fingertips these days. You know, if you Google urban spelunking, you'll find links to groups you can join, and you'll find explanations of what they do. I think you also find actual sites that are popular, like abandoned. I mentioned one, I think, in the book, an abandoned boys' school, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then these urban explorers, these urban spelunkers, can go to these sites and crawl around and you know, do whatever urban spelunkers do.
Because straight away, you as a reader, you're thinking there is a reason why these places have been abandoned, and also that they could, you know, there's the danger of collapse at any time, which of course there is if you do, you know, the regular kind of spelunking. But it gives it an added frisson, doesn't it?
I'm not an urban spelunker, but I would think it certainly would for me.
Yeah.
To go into some creepy old building with, you know, spiders and cracks in the walls and whatever.
I'm sure the basics of forensic anthropology will always be the same, but the technologies change. How has the science of forensic anthropology changed since you were in your heyday back in a few years ago?
Are you implying I'm no longer?
Well, I know you don't do it, but you know, obviously, you're in your heyday now as a writer, Kathy. Back in the day when you were doing the FA work yourself.
Oh, I think the big gorilla is DNA, of course. When I started back in the day, you know, DNA wasn't a thing. We knew it existed, I think. But it really didn't become what it is now. And we probably, as I recall, we would take bone samples of every case and keep a little plug of bone from every case, just in case future technologies were developed. But we didn't routinely do DNA as a means of identifying. You can't really identify. You can't use, well, there may be techniques now of which I'm not aware, but you couldn't, back in the day, it was a comparative technique. You could get DNA from your unknown And then if you could compare that to a known individual, you could get an identification in that way. I think there are some identifiers you can derive from just DNA in a vacuum. Skin color and eye color and that sort of thing. Now the genome has been worked out for some physical features. But mainly back in the day, it was just a comparative. You got DNA from your unknown, your cadaver that somebody found, you know, in their well or wherever. And then when you got a possible suspect that you thought it was, you could compare to see if you had a match or not a match.
So it makes it's made the job easier?
DNA?
Yeah.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. And it's like anything else. It gets smaller, quicker, cheaper, you know. So back in the day, it was a big deal to do DNA. And you don't always get DNA. You can't always extract it from remains. And the older the remains, the more degraded the remains, the lower your chances of getting DNA. And depending on what context the remains were in, if they were buried, you have a pretty good chance of getting it. If they came out of the water or they were on the surface or they'd been put in a bath of acid or something, you know, you don't always get DNA.
So let me tell you something you've just touched on there with DNA. It sort of throws up in my mind the problem that thriller writers have or had with mobile phones. In other words, years ago, you could have a set of circumstances in a book where people don't know where everyone else is. You'd read that book now and go, oh, right, you just call them up on their mobile. You'd know exactly instantly where they are. And I wonder whether DNA had a similar impact on thriller writers, just thriller writers themselves, where you need to work that little bit harder because we're all now, we might not, you know, encounter DNA analysis in our daily lives, but we certainly see it on TV and in films. We all assume that every murder scene is, oh, there's going to be some DNA there and they're going to track down the killer from that. And I just wonder whether it's that added little bit of an obstacle for thriller writers where they know, I know my reader is going to be expecting this, so I need to show them that the DNA isn't going to work or the mobile signal isn't going to work in that particular forest. So therefore, forget your mobile phone and forget your DNA as a possible solution to this murder.
Yeah, you have to deal with it. You have to address it. You can come up with reasons why you're not going to have DNA or you're not going to have mobile phone, you know, records or cell towers to ping from or whatever. But you do have to address it, I think, unless you want to set your book back, you know, in 1962 or something, which is perfectly fine to do.
Do you still go to the annual meeting of America's Forensic Anthropologists, Kathy?
I go to the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and that's everybody. There are 9, 10, 11 sections within the academy. There's one for pathology and biology. There's one for forensic chemistry. There's one for fire and arson. There's one for psychiatry. You know, everybody's there. So I go to that forensic anthropology. We changed the name of our section from, well, we were physical anthropology. We dropped the physical. So we're now just the anthropology section. So alphabetically, we'd be first. So, yeah, I attend those meetings every year. They move around. This year, and it's always in February. So it's coming up. And it'll be in New Orleans this year. So I do go. And I go. I don't just attend the anthropology sessions, but I float around and I go to all the different specialty areas and sit in on papers on all kinds of different topics of forensic science to get, you know, ideas for books, for future stories.
So when you go, because is it next month? I think it's next month. So will you go there with your pen and paper, metaphorically speaking, and be thinking, okay, I know what we're doing next? In fact, you probably know what you're doing next because you said that you wrote this book quite a few years ago. But that must be a fantastic treasure trove of ideas and characters.
As is the journal, the JFS, the Journal of Forensic Science, just flipping through that because you can't attend every session at the meetings. They're going on simultaneously on all different, there are thousands of us there. These are really big, well, by our standards, these are really big meetings. It's not like the American Pediatric Society or something, but where you have tens of thousands. But yeah, there are lots of different scientists from all different specialty areas. So it's a, as you say, it's a treasure trove. And not just attending the presentations, but just schmoozing. That's where I find the most valuable interaction to be, where you just at the cocktail hour or the, you know, the wine, there's always a wine and cheese reception, the opening night, that kind of thing. And just talking to people from all the different specialty areas.
And what does the future hold for Temperance Brennan?
I'm not sure. I'm between, I'm currently not under contract. This last book was the last book for which I was under contract. So I'm free to do whatever I want to, I guess, basically. So I really am taking a little break. I'm on what we would call in television hiatus. So I'll figure that out in the upcoming months.
Okay, so I'm just pushing this a bit. Is this a creative hiatus out of which you will emerge as a new butterfly with more temperance stories? Or have you come up with some other fabulous character that we're going to enjoy reading?
Well, I have thrown out some other characters out there in short stories, for example, or young adult literature that I've done. So I've toyed with the idea of taking one of those more minor characters and expanding it into a main character. And I've also toyed with the idea of doing another Temperance Brennan. We'll see.
It does sound as though your mind is genuinely open.
Yes. Yes, it is.
That must be quite... Is that an exciting or a scary place to be?
No, that's fun. That's fun. I like that idea that I can do something new and different and not just another Temperance Brennan book.
For readers, our latest Kathy Reich's book is called Evil Bones. It's a classic Kathy Reich's book. People are going to enjoy it enormously, I think. There'll be more with Kathy when she takes our Q&A, which will be along in a few days' time. But for the moment, Kathy Reich's, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Well, thank you.